You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is Will Matthey's interview with actor Russell Hornsby from The Hate U Give.
Man, you coming at me for my music, but you listen to this old stuff.
Old stuff? What? You better get up out of here with all that pockets of truth.
Hello, I got a boyfriend.
Yeah, I heard, but it's all good.
Really?
We've been together our whole lives, Star. We got time.
My name is Star. Two R's. Daddy named me that. Garden Heights. Mama and Daddy says our life is here because our people are here. We got Mr. Rubin's Barbecue, Mr. Lewis's Barbershop, and Daddy's Store.
The high school is where you go to get junk, high, or pregnant. We don't go there. Williamson is another world, so when I'm here, I'm Star version 2.
Yo, those kids are lit!
Basically, Williamson Star doesn't give anyone a reason to call her ghetto.
And I hate myself for doing it. Until the weekend comes around. I get those goosebumps
every time. What's up? Where you been at?
Man, I don't know. You be hanging with all the white kids.
Shut up. Yeah, when you're not around, when you throw that to
the side. Out of the car.
Yo, Star, you okay?
Go back where he told you.
Khalil.
I'm not playing. Go back where... What did you do?
Today, Garden Heights is reeling after the shooting of a 17-year-old black teenager by a white police officer.
We live in a complicated world.
It doesn't seem that complicated to me.
Violence, brutality. It's the same story, just a different name.
When I attack with impact, it's real tactful. The black cat waited and sat, debated to...
It's best if she don't talk to 5-0.
She's threatening her. It's about more than just Khalil. It's about black people, poor people, everybody at the bottom. I need to speak for him. You think we can never achieve the inconceivable?
We don't belong, but we here unbelievable. When you're ready to talk, you talk. Don't ever let nobody make you be quiet. I ain't named you Star by accident.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to an episode of the Next Best Picture podcast. I'm your host, Will Matthey. And with me, I have Russell Hornsby, who's been generating waves with his incredible performance as the father, Maverick, in Fox's The Hate U Give. Russell, how you doing, man?
I'm doing really well. Doing really well. It's a wonderful Friday morning here.
So, you know, we've seen you mainly on stage in productions like Fences. I mean, we've seen you in Grimm, but this is one of the first big film roles you ended up with, and it's punched you right into the Oscar conversation. How did you end up with George Tillman on this project? Like, how did Mav come to you?
Well, you know, I was, you know, I'm still at the place in my career where, you know, you have agents and managers submit you for jobs. And I had no, this film, this project was not on my radar, nor was the book. And while I was in New York last year doing 7 Seconds, they sent the script. And what really got me is they said, Russell, here's the script. You have to read it. And they want you to be put on tape and you have to turn around by tomorrow morning, basically 18 hours from right now.
Oh, God.
And, you know, after I finished, you know, cussing them out, you know, just because as an actor, you want to be able to, you know, work on your auditions, I realized I just had to dive into it. And once I read the opening salvo, that opening moment between the talk, that just grabbed me. And I realized, okay, I can offer something to this. I put myself on tape. A couple weeks later, I'm in front of George having lunch, and we're talking about the script. We're talking about the character. And I'm a very passionate person just by nature. And I just looked George dead in the eye, and I said, George, you're not going to find anybody who can play this better than me. I'm telling you that. And he, you know, he shook his head like, okay, I hear you. And then I delve into a monologue from an August Wilson play, The King Henry II, which is a very similar character to Maverick, very grounded and very naturalistic and, you know, from the quote-unquote hood and whatnot. And he was taken aback by that. So, you know, now from that moment, we had to go prove it to Fox. And after another audition a week later. I put my hair in cornrows, everything like you see at the top of the movie. And I think that's what sold him, you know, had a wonderful audition. And then, you know, the interesting thing was, in the middle of the audition, he says, Russell, do you mind learning? Can you, you know, do another scene? I said, yes. He said, we want you to do the opening monologue from the movie.
Oh, my God.
You know, he said, well, no, take your time. Go take your time. You know that it's like, take your time and hurry up. So I went into one of the offices, and he says, don't worry about it. You can have the script, you know, in front of you. And I was just like seething underneath, you know what I mean? Like, I'm calling him every name but the child of God. I go into the room 20 minutes later. I come out. I have the whole thing memorized, and I laid it.
Oh.
And, you know, but that's the theater training. That's me being the theater actor I am and saying, okay, this is a challenge. I'm going to take this challenge on, and here we go.
God damn. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about that scene, honestly? Because were you ever given the talk? And if so, how did yours differ?
Yeah, the talk for me and my brother, we were raised in a single-parent household. My mother raised my brother and I. And there was never just this, like, the sit down and tell you what's kind of going on. There were more sort of just lessons along the way. So, you know, once you start getting into mischief as a kid, you know, TPing somebody's house, stealing apples from somebody's tree, that's when mom would start buffering it by saying, listen, you know, if you think you're going to be, you know, one of these kids that goes around here and gets in trouble, I don't recommend that, because, you know, the cops, you know, when they take black boys like you and they take them to jail, you know.
Yeah.
I grew up in a mixed neighborhood, so I had white friends and black friends. And so my mother would tell us, they'll send your white friends home and they'll send you to jail.
Mm.
And so that was the common refrain for my mom as I was growing up. And as you're growing up, it gets more layered and more detailed. But it started with that. You'll go to jail. Well, they'll go home. You know, you fight, they'll send you to juvie. They'll send your white counterparts home.
Mm.
You know, juvenile hall. That's how it was sort of explained to us. And then as we got older, it became more detailed and more explicit.
So you had that intense scene, which I'm sure was one of the most difficult to do in the film.
Mm-hmm.
What went into creating Mav for you before you even got on screen?
You know, I as I said, being from the theater, Will, I was fortunate enough because the material was so rich and the character was so rich and depth and deep and detailed. I knew that I had to approach it as I would a play, and which means I had to unpack the whole script. Just break it all the way down and really find the character. And so in doing that, I sequestered myself for a month. I have a wife. I have two children. I asked my wife, and she was very open to it, if she wouldn't mind going to her parents' house while I stay home and prepare. And what I looked at that time while I was home, I looked at it as that was Mav's incarceration. You know, that was him being in, that was his imprisonment. You know, I had to sort of model that, you know, that feeling of being isolated, of being in prison. And so you do the same things that one would. I wanted to sort of follow that pattern. You read, you write, you listen to what music that you can get a hold of. You're left with your own thoughts. And those thoughts that I'm left with are thoughts about the character. Well, you know, I write the detailed backstory. I write, you know, what his relationship with his father was like, his relationship with his mother, what he did when he was a kid, all through adolescence and all through, you know, young adulthood into adulthood. How does him being in prison impact him now? What does Mav want to do when he gets out? And all that corresponds with aspects of the book and aspects of the screenplay, so that you have a fully fleshed out, fully realized character with a depth and breadth that a soul can reach. And and so you come out on the other end 30 days later. I went in, you know, a caterpillar, and I came out a butterfly.
So it's, I mean, it sounds like you went pretty much method with this. Were there any moments in the film where it felt like you weren't even acting? It was almost just you?
You know, honestly, the whole film was that. And, you know, George was very kind enough to allow us 2.5 weeks of rehearsal. And so we were able to really bond as a family and as a cast. And I didn't realize how deep we were in the character, into the roles and into the movie, until we had to come back and reshoot and bring in KJ Apa, because it was so difficult to find in the reshoots for me to find Mav again.
Mm.
And so Regina Hall and I were talking about it. I said, babe, we were in this, weren't we? She said, yeah, honey. We were really in this world. You know, we were, you know, acting as a family. Regina and I just had such a loving relationship as a husband and wife. The way we communicated with each other, the way we worked together as two actors dealing with the kids, you know, who played the actors who played our kids. We were just really in it. The community, all the extras, everything, like they just enveloped. They took us in, and we were under that sheet of protection, you know, that cloak of protection, that hedge of protection from everybody. And we were just in the world of the hate you give. And it was, you know, when it was over, I realized, wow, I had really given up myself in a way that I had not done in a long time.
Well, so in a role that, in a film that everybody gets so into, I imagine that also means with heavy subject matter that, like, emotions and tensions were high. Was it difficult being in a set where everybody's so into it, so passionate, and tackling something so weighty?
Actually, it was the opposite. You know, to be honest with you, I think everybody understood what the subject matter was. Everybody understood what we were there to do. And the truth of it is, Will, we were able to have so much fun. I mean, and I say that, there was never a moment of, like, tension after cut. You know, after each take or after each scene, we were able to let that go and start telling jokes and laughing at each other and poking fun. And then once rolling came, everybody got back to where they needed to be, got into it. Action, let's go, let's do it. And then cut, and we were back to being our joyous, fun-loving self. Because, Will, because the truth of the matter is, Will, this subject matter is not new to us in Black. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the truth is, we always have to find joy inside the pain. We always have to find joy inside the tears, as Stevie Wonder says. You know, so we weren't dour. We didn't feel burdened emotionally by, like, oh, we had this big responsibility. Everybody came with their A game. Everyone was prepared. So in light of that, we were just able to have fun and be really a family on set.
Well, and that shows in the film, honestly, because it goes from such heavy material to a hilarious moment where you first meet Star's boyfriend, which is one of the funniest moments I've seen on screen this year.
Thank you.
I mean, you guys are able to go back and forth so deftly on tone. Because the film does make itself, you know, it's a very accessible film to mainstream audiences. Is there anything you wish the film could have gone deeper into, tackled theme-wise?
You know, possibly, but then we wouldn't have the film we have. And I do think it is important that the film be accessible, because what we're really trying to do, Will, ultimately, is change hearts and minds, you know?
Yeah.
And so you can, you know, you have to meet people where they are, you know? And so I think that was the objective of, I think, the way George approached the film, is to meet people where they are and give them an opportunity to see a different side of Black life, you know, a different side of Black culture. And if we don't come, as the film, metaphorically speaking, with the film, with our arms open, do you know?
Yeah.
If we have to force the audience to open our arms, to grab hold and say, you're come in, then people won't receive it well, I believe. I really believe that. Mm. And I hope that this is a start of different kinds of conversation, different dialogue. I hope that it brings about a level of understanding and empathy that will invoke that kind of dialogue. But you can only do it if you do it by not pointing fingers. That was the whole thing. We didn't want to point fingers and say you're to blame. We just wanted to say, look at how we are, look at how we live. And we have these fundamental obstacles, but we also have these fundamental truths and similarities in our lives and in our culture that are the same, you know? So, yeah. You know, it's the saying goes, well, when I was in high school, my religion teacher, Mr. Harper, I've been saying this a lot, but it's worth repeating. You know, we used to walk around with these T-shirts that say, it's a black thing you wouldn't understand, right? Mm-hmm. Now that's the movie. Now look at that and say, that's part of the film having a different tone, right? So I walk around with a T-shirt that says, it's a black thing you wouldn't understand. So what I do is my tone pushes you away, correct?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So if you take on that same tone from a filmic standpoint, what we end up doing is pushing people away. So what my religion teacher taught us in light of us walking around with those T-shirts, he says, gentlemen, I disagree. I actually think you're wrong. He said, it's not a black thing you wouldn't understand. It's a black thing. Let me help you understand. Mm. Right? So now what we do, Will, is we change the tone. And so in just doing that, we invite you in and you feel welcome. And so now you don't have the same level of possible resentment or a feeling of being put upon or fingers pointed. You say, okay, let me step in and see what they're talking about. So there's a willingness now because we're saying, let me help you understand.
Would you say, I mean, this sounds like this was you remember this guy from 10th grade. Would you say there was any of him in Mav? Is he kind of a mentor for you as well?
He was, you know, Maverick reflects a lot of the men that helped me become the man I am. But what more importantly, with this Mr. Harper and a lot of men who helped raise me, what is in Mav, it's the candor. It's being forthright. It's being truthful. It's being direct. That's important. I think also, I was raised at a time when you were seen and not heard. Mm. I was raised at a time when men and women, mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, told you exactly what was on their mind, and you had to deal with it. So if you were wrong, they would tell you you were wrong. They told you with love, but they told you you're wrong. You know what I mean? Yeah. There was no sugarcoating it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You're wrong. And so Mav is a throwback to that time. Where, hey, kids, Star, Seven, I love you, but you're wrong. So let's get this straight. Let's fix it. And again, you can't have that kind of candor, that kind of truth, if you're not present every day in your kids' lives.
Yeah.
And so Mav is able to do that because he's present in his kids' lives. He's there for their mother. He's there for his wife. He's present for the community. So when he speaks, people listen because he's respected by everybody, by all those around him. And that's the image that I wanted to put forth of black men. That we are represented well in our community, we are present in our community, and we're there, and we're an integral, integral part of our community.
Trying to make some sense out of it.
It's thug life. The hate you give little infants.
F's everybody. I know what it stands for. What do you think it means?
I think it's about us.
Us who?
Black people. Poor people, everybody at the bottom.
Right, you want it? Pac was trying to school us on how the system's designed against us. Why else you think so many people in our neighborhood deal?
They need the money.
Yeah. And they no real jobs around here. So they fall into the trap.
Through all this, because, you know, you've created this respected figure, but he has so many layers, so many elements. Was there a moment that was most difficult to pull off as Mav?
Yes, there was. I think possibly two, but obviously the most challenging was the talk, because that I had a visceral reaction when we went to shoot. I had to leave the set for about 20 minutes and just purge my tears, because I couldn't stop thinking about my boys as I'm looking at these two children that I have to give this talk to.
How old are your kids?
My kids are 3 and 1.
Oh, okay. They're very young.
And one of those things where, you know, and I got two boys, and I said, this is painful. And because I substituted my boys for those kids, and I said, this hurts. So I had to regroup, find my, you know, regain my strength, and come back and be there for those kids. You know, that was one scene. And, you know, the other was that lawn scene.
The lineup scene?
Yeah, the lineup scene. Because, again, well, I had to restrain from showing any emotion. You know, I had to refrain from showing any visible, no waterworks, basically. Because I'm trying to impart to them that you have an opportunity that I didn't have. And in that, you have to be strong. And because, you know, the thing, the reality of it is, Will, that wasn't Mav talking to Star, Seven, and Sakani. That was Russell talking to Amandala, Lamar, and TJ. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was me as an elder statesman saying to these younger, beautiful, talented, bright kids that you have to take this baton that I'm giving you and you have to run that race now. You know, what you see in Amandala, the kind of activism, feminism that she's showing, is her taking that baton.
She's on the cover of Time, isn't she?
Absolutely. She represents that next generation. And so it was Russell saying to them, it's your time now. Embrace it. Take it to a different level. Take it to a different place. Be about change. Speak out. Don't be afraid. You guys have it in you. And it was hard, because I'm an emotional, feeling person. And I wanted to cry and hug them in that moment. I really did. As Russell, I wanted to take them in my arms and say, I love you. I believe in you. You can do it. That's what I wanted to show. That's what that moment meant for me. It was a passing of the baton. You know what I mean? Like, literally and figuratively.
I'm getting chills just hearing this right now. it's almost like you just gave me a monologue. That was awesome. Which does make me wonder, what do you want to do next? You know, people know your name. People know Russell Hornsby now. I know you're in Creed 2 later this year, right?
Yes. You know, and again, this is not me trying to self-aggrandize, but I really feel that I possess something very unique. And what I mean by that, because of my theater training, because of my background and my extensive time in the theater, but because of the man or the actor I've developed into, I feel I have that lovely mix of being a leading man, a leading character actor. Do you know?
Yeah.
Barefaced man, everyday guy, you know, in the vein of like an Ezekiel Rollins or something like that. But I can also put on the nose. I can transform into a whole different character, a whole host of different people. I can be funny. I can, you know, just play characters, change voices, and, you know, surprise people and, you know, all these kinds of things where people don't really understand who I am, and, you know, all of those things. I'm almost schizophrenic in that way, you know. But so it's that's in me, and I want to show all of all those facets of my creativity that way, because that's how I that's my artistry. That's my gift to the community, is me absorbing all of these aspects of humanity and then internalizing it and then giving it back and putting a mirror up to society, a mirror up to the community, a mirror up to humankind, you know, and in saying to people, what do you see? Who, what does this mean to you? That's what my objective is. So I want to play roles that are challenging, roles that are dynamic, roles that are cause me to go to a greater depth of my artistry that haven't been, you know, displayed up to this point. You know, as I said, I mentioned E.Z. Rollins. I would love to revive that series that Denzel Washington brought to life so brilliantly in Devil in a Blue Dress.
Oh, wow.
That's really a hope and a goal of mine to do that. I would love to go back to the stage. I have this dream of playing Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh my God, you know, that'd be great.
At some point. I would love to do a version of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on the stage. I feel I have something to offer. You know, there's all these things that are in my bailiwick that I really feel that I can bring a different spin to that people will take and receive and learn and get and gain something from.
Well, do you have any projects lined up we haven't heard about so far? After The Affair and Creed 2?
And Creed 2, well, right now I'm in Chicago working on a television series called Proven Innocent. And I play a lawyer in that who is working to, right the wrongs of the wrongfully convicted. And so that's going to be on Fox starting in January. We're shooting 13 episodes.
That's fantastic.
But, you know, right now, honestly, Will, I'm being patient. I think for me, it's wise to have a wait and see approach because film can be so dynamic, because film can be so influential. You really want to take your time and selecting the next film role, film lead or supporting lead that's out there for me.
Have you considered any musicals with your love of the stage? And we're in the middle of a musical resurgence right now.
You know, I would, but here's the thing. I would need, I can't sing as well. You know what I mean? So if that full thing of, I would have to become a star. And so it would be Guys and Dolls starring Russell Hornsby as Scott. You know what I mean? And I could sell the hell out of a song. You know
sure,
what I mean?
Sure.
I can't necessarily sing to the heavens, you know?
Of course.
But I can sell a song because I'm so theatrical and I can hold a tune. But it would have to be, oh my God, we're here to see Russell Hornsby. This is great. You know what I mean? So when they're so much more in love with seeing me than they are hearing my, my velvet tones, you know what I mean? I mean, I am no Leslie Odom Jr. for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, Russell Crowe got away with it in Les Mis, and I'm sure you sound better than that, so.
Oh yeah, no, I could totally get down. Yes, absolutely. I would love the challenge, though. I really would. I would really embrace the challenge.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but before I go, I mean, you've appeared on all over the talk show circuit. You've done a lot of interviews. What has no one asked you that you wish they would about The Hate U Give and your performance so far?
You know, wow, just what it means to me. What this film means to me. You know, we rarely get these opportunities to tell our truth, to tell our truth our way. And this is, I felt like it's one of those rare opportunities that we didn't get it right or wrong. We got it truthful. And that's why it means so much to me, because we were honest and truthful and authentic in that. And because there is only truth. And so I think that I'm impacted by it in such a way, because I do feel the love and the truth that we put forth in the film. And so it means that kids will be able to see it. From here to beyond, it means that we're leaving a lasting legacy in the film, you know, for in the broader sense for the film community. I mean, this has, now I feel that I'm a part of some of history almost. This has the same, I hope it has the same, leaves the same example as like Boys in the Hood.
Oh, wow.
Because Boys in the Hood, I know what I'm saying. I hope it defines a generation the way Boys in the Hood did for me. Boys in the Hood defined my generation coming up, you know, and I hope that this film is able to do that for this generation. And they can, we can look back in 20 years and say that was a seminal film at a very important time. And it raised a collective consciousness and brought people together in however small a fashion, but it still brought them together.
I'm so glad that you brought us this film and this character. You know, it's, I look forward to seeing you throughout the rest of the season. If you haven't seen the film yet, to our listeners, I implore you to go check it out because you will not be disappointed. And Russell, I wish you best of luck this season and on your future on-screen roles. I hope we do one day get to a point where people say, I'm going to go see this musical because Russell Hornsby's in it. So,
thank you, Will. I appreciate it. I really do.
Best of luck, man. And you have a wonderful rest of the fall.
All right. You too. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Will Mavity's interview with Russell Hornsby from The Hate U Give, which is now currently playing in theaters. You can subscribe to the Next Best Picture podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, CastBox, Acast, and now recently on Spotify. Be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. Let us know what you think of the show. And if you're feeling generous, head on over to Patreon, where for $1 minimum a month, you can get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.